It's a very great pleasure to welcome you all on behalf of the director to this lecture by Professor Nicholas Luhmann. The lecture forms part of a series marking the centenary of the school, and we're really honoured to be able to associate Professor Luhmann's first visit to the school with that occasion. You have visited us once. We hope you will come again often. Our lecturer is too well known to require any elaborate introduction. He has taught at the University of Bielefeld since its foundation, and his writings there have given him a preeminent place among contemporary social theorists. All of us, I think, must be intrigued by the title that Professor Luhmann has chosen for his lecture this morning, Systems Theory and Postmodernism. As confidence faltered in the capacity of Marx, Durkheim, and Weber's work to yield an exhaustive understanding of the social world, a number of routes forward began to emerge. One of these involved a rigorous, even austere reinvocation of systems theory, and that is the route which we predominantly associate with Professor Luhmann. Another route is represented by some unconstrained, eclectic projects of deconstruction grouped under the label of postmodernism. On the face of it, there's some distance between these two programs, even a sense that any attempt at admixture would generate turbulence. But the title of Professor Luhmann's lecture is perhaps suggestive of some link. I invite him now to relieve that suspense. Thank you, Professor Luhmann.
Well, thank you very much for your kind introduction, and to the school, thank you for the invitation. I was not sure what kind of topic I should choose for the for this lecture, and the idea was to take a fashionable title, postmodernism. But with fashion, we have our problems. We are not sure whether we are in the beginning or on the peak of the fashion or already on its decline. And I think the discussion of about postmodernity has already some length of so that you can see what is meant and what is defined as postmodernism. And my impression is that it is already declining a little bit, or repeating, feeding upon itself, and ignoring some similar intellectual endeavors outside of this topic, postmodernism. And so the title of my lecture is should draw attention to the capacities of science, maybe formalism, maybe poetry, to do similar things which are not visible in the narrow discussion on postmodern society. But I have to begin with a few personal remarks, because originally I had no interest at all in this literature on postmodernity. And there were several reasons not to use too much time to read all this literature. The first was that my impression was that it is a purely semantical discussion, without any reference to the structural and operational realities of modern society. It was just intellectual talk and trying to make sense out of a mixture of distance to realities and intellectual re-descriptions of previous descriptions. And this was not very much to my taste. Then, of course, there were other things. For example, a meeting with Lyotard, who said quite bluntly that La Condition Postmoderne is not one of his best books. And he was not sure whether the title Postmodernity in the end of the 70s, taken out of architecture, was appropriate for philosophy or for all kinds of intellectual movements of our days. Then I tried to see whether we could subsume certain developments in different fields, say the economy or law or politics or schools and so under postmodern, under distinction modern postmodern, and have a kind of temporal synchronicity in the sense that the change from modern to postmodern is about in the 20s or in the 40s or in the 70s in all fields. But this is, of course, clearly not possible. On the contrary, I found that the modern developments in all these function systems are more or less continuous, or if there are discontinuities, then they are not within one time period, and they are very different in different systems. So you may ask whether the typically monetary economy has a new phase with this kind of derivative trades, and whether this is postmodern, that people for some time thought that they could do without industry, living just from manipulating the money of others. Whether this is postmodern or not, this was, of course, the late 70s or the 80s. But then if you look at schools, what is postmodern in the development of schools? Everybody has to go to school, and this is at least since the 19th century. So, and we try to mobilize capacities via schools, but when does a postmodern area begin in schools? It's difficult to say. Perhaps if you have too many reforms, and a reform need, of course, a kind of lack of memory, a kind of forgetfulness, why previous reforms did not succeed. You have to forget this and begin a new reform, but then this is also in Germany in the 60s or so the case, and and you could see in the political field what is postmodernism. This is political rhetoric as the substance of political talk, political communication, the distrust in the liberal constitutional state and the scheme which makes it possible to distinguish parties. Is this postmodern? So my impression was, on the whole, that there is a continuity in well, mostly functional differentiation and the high degree of dynamics and autonomy of function systems. And this means also that function systems overuse their freedom or their autonomy and create problems for themselves and for other systems. But this is just what we could expect from a theory of modern society, and it doesn't make any sense for me to make a period postmodern after modern society. Then I looked at some of the literature on postmodernity, and I found not very revealing insights. One is, of course, there is no unitary symbolism, no meta-récit, meta-narration, I think. I don't know how they do it in English. But at least there's no symbol, universally accepted, consensual symbol of the unity of a system anymore, but there are several descriptions. That's, of course, the point of Lyotard, and I found this interesting, but then the question is, of course, and I go into this in a few minutes, how could this happen and what does it mean? Then there is the idea of no binding tradition, tradition for longer binding, but then you find this already very early, partly in the 17th century, for example, in the legal theories of the 17th century. In the common law area, the idea was that you could not found the validity of common law on the legality of the Norman immigration into Britain. So whether this was, it was at that time, of course, 11th century, discussed whether there was a right to take the British crown and or not, but this could not be the basis for understanding the common law, because it's the wisdom of generations of decision making and so on, refining the instruments, which really is the rationality of common law. And we had in Germany also the discussion whether the introduction of civil law into Germany was an statute of the empire, of the emperor Lothar, or not. And the first history of German law in the 17th century made the point that it is just a development. And interestingly enough, the last chapter of this kind of investigation was a chapter on reform. So there is a kind of historicity and a correlate to this in the idea of reform as a permanent task to reform the law. And is this postmodern or not? But it is 17th century. So the only case where I could find any clear meaning is architecture. We had the modern style, the highly reductive, simplifying, and so modern style. And then in the 17th, the idea that a building should be open to the environment. I mean, it should have contact to other buildings and to streets and to space around it. And not just being a reductive monument of simplification and form. And it should also appeal to different tastes of perspective, different types of education of people, different types of expectations of what a good form is, a mixture of style, possibly. And so there's a clear break in the 70s. And as far as I know, Lyotard did take the term postmodernity from architecture. But then if you look at poetry or at the novel, and so you find no clear distinction between a modern and a postmodern area. There's a lot of discussion about this, whether we make a distinction between modernism and late modernism and postmodernism, and how the authors fit into this scheme. But this is already very unclear. So on the whole, I didn't see any sense into working with this kind of theory of postmodern society or postmodern intellectuality, philosophy, or whatever, until I became aware that my own work was associated with postmodernism. And this came as a kind of surprise. We had in September a meeting in the Indiana University in Bloomington, postmodernism and system theory, just to make clear or discuss why I am stubbornly refuse to describe the modern society as a postmodern society and using a postmodern theory to do this. And so I take the topic for this lecture out of this kind of surprise and this kind of reflection. What is going on? Why my own ideas and the literature to which I normally refer, it's more formalistic than poetry, but why is this, has this to do with postmodernity? And if so, why the frame of discussion of postmodernity is so narrow and did ignore developments, say, in cybernetics, in systems theory, in communication theory, in second order observation points, and so. And what I want now to do is to take the cue in the idea that postmodernity has to renounce the symbolization of the unity of a system, and in my case, the society. This is not simply a present reality, but this has a history. And I would like to draw your attention in one part of this lecture to the development of the symbolization of unity in modern society. And I insist on modern society. I think the development begins in the 17th century when the old hierarchical structure lost its plausibility as nature, as the nature of the organism of society. There should be a ruling group and there should be nobility and commoners, there should be religion and so on and so forth, as a condition of the unity, of the natural unity of society. When this was no longer plausible, partly the split in the religious confessions, partly the crisis of the aristocracy in the 16th, 17th centuries, monetary problems and so on and so forth, the idea that aristocracy, especially in France, is a state institution, an institution of positive law and nothing else, not something natural. Then, of course, the idea that the society is, by nature, hierarchical did no longer convince anybody, and they had to invent substitutes. I think the first substitute was happiness, in the sense that everybody can be happy in a society, whatever his condition, as long as he is satisfied with his condition. So happiness for everybody was a kind of natural argument which crosscuts the hierarchy, and it was even referring to a long theological tradition, clear that high-class people are not necessarily happy, perhaps even more unhappy than other people, because their aspirations are very high and their life is without full of boring and full of ennui in France. And so the first idea was happiness. Happiness as a natural possibility of human beings as long as they are accept certain conditions of life as invariants and as their own position in society. This is Alexander Pope would be an English author for this kind of thing, Molière in France. This lasted until the middle of the 18th century, and then things began to shift, and I'm not quite clear why. Partly, perhaps, the increasing impact of a new property conception, partly the enclosure movement, and partly the increasing legal machinery, new statutes and so. At least in since the French Revolution, the idea that the society, the modern society, is not simply a sum total of all the individual happinesses or unhappinesses. So the mental frame of the individual became more and more important point in the argument. But just because this was so, you could not have a uniform idea about individuals anymore. Individuals are individuals, they are different. And so we needed another type of theory of society. On the whole, solidarity was the next slogan. And it shifts from nature to morality, to a normative framework. First, of course, in the workers' movements, at least at the end of the 19th century, with the sociology, solidarity, especially in France, was a term for the society. A society without solidarity would not be a society, and there should be integration. There should be a minimum of consensus. And of course, Durkheim's De la division du travail social is one of the monographs which makes this point. But then this did again vanish somehow and was replaced by the idea that the political system should care for the for a similarity, not equality complete, but a similarity of living conditions for everybody. So the developing countries, the problem of the poor, the problem of the excluded population, the Copenhagen meeting now is just another example of this kind of concern with people who suffer, who have no chance in life, no perspectives, no future, and are the victims of a capitalistic or modern development. So the active society, in the sense of Etzioni, was the next idea. And dominating much of the social policy and the developing policy of our century. But then, even in Manhattan, one didn't succeed in making equal living conditions. You have to move from the Fifth Avenue to the ABCD avenues to see the difference. And if this is not possible in Manhattan, how could we expect that it is possible in a kind of world, global framework? So again, this this idea is on a normative level, on a level of preferences and values, undisputed, but the realization is increasingly problematic. And if you see the comments on the Copenhagen meeting, you find always it's beautiful, wonderful ideas, but how to do it, how to proceed practically in this kind of equalization of or similarization of living conditions. So at the end of this century, we have to, I think we have to accept a society which is without happiness, without solidarity, and without equality of living conditions. And then they invented traditional terms, civil society, a kind of seminar-type discussion, a critical discussion about problems as the last possibility to maintain the unity by being critical, just by having a distance or making a difference between aspirations and reasonable solutions and the realities they found. So the civil society or the communitarian movement is already somehow the question whether we could use a unity symbol as a symbol which neutralizes differences within the society, and the difference as such becomes the symbol. We cannot affirm the society, we cannot accept the society as it is. And the difference is the unity. But this is only one way to see the things. It refers to, of course, to stratification. The difference which people have in mind and this kind of happiness, solidarity, active society talk is the stratification, class society and so. But there are other forms of differentiation, and we have similar developments in if you look at the society as functionally differentiated system. We have also a kind of development in the sense of an increasing utopian or normative framework and an increasing difficulty to place hope into the solutions of the unity problem or the solutions or the replacement of the bad consequences of differentiation with something more or less utopian. The thing started at the end of the 19th century with the idea of division of labor. So you could see functional differentiation as division of labor, and this meant at that time that there's a kind of surplus value and a kind of classical or neoclassical economic scheme, in the sense that if we accept differentiation, functional differentiation, if politicians make politics and the economy makes profits, or and the law makes good legal decisions and so on. Everybody does his own job, and then the results would be better in a kind of vague sense. If in the economy, of course, that's profitable use of capital and labor, but in the society, what would be the better situation as a consequence of division of labor? Durkheim was not very clear about this. He simply found the lack of solidarity as the problem, and if we could compensate for division of labor by a new type of organic solidarity, then the problem would be solved. But then in the during this century, the emphasis shifted from division of labor to a modernization theory which looked at different function systems as such. So in the political system, we should care for democratic solutions, maximize consensus and minimize force in the hands of politicians. And in the economy, there should be a market society. There should be a credit available for finding the best point in time for consumption or for production. In the school education system, of course, we have to have schools which use the capacity of individuals for learning and for developing their own natural capabilities. In the legal system, we should have rule of law or Rechtsstaat in the German sense, which controls even the political system. Science, of course, should be organized around methods and theories and not around ideological assumptions or religious topics. Mass media, the same. So the idea was that if only we would modernize all these function systems in a certain Western type of orientation, then this would be the result would be a better society in the sense that the function systems support each other. If we have good schools, we have good labor. If we have good labor, we have high productivity, then we can use surplus money to compensate for social problems, and if we have free press and free scientific research, we would be nearer to discovering the truth and having exact information about the situation of our society, and so on and so forth. The idea was, and this was not very much elaborate, but simply assumed that the dynamics of function system, which were visible also as a, if you compare modern society with traditional societies, if these dynamics were just set free, then the system would grow, growth as the central phantom of modern society, and then everything would be better than before. Independently of whether we have a regional idea about convergent trends or whether we accept that regions have different routes towards a modern society. But this ignores some troublesome facts that the function systems, if they operate on their own as operationally closed function systems, they can create problems which cannot be solved in other systems. So one of the examples, of course, science, the atomic energy, atomic bomb problems as a political problem, and the scientists, of course, say, well, we can do this, and we can show this, and if it is possible, it's hardly to resist the use, either in economic terms or in political terms. But then how can the political system regulate the use of atomic energy or the atomic possibility of atomic warfare? And increasingly now, I think that the science, we have a very developed science in ecological problems, but they create not only knowledge but also ignorance, and more ignorance than knowledge, especially if you want to have an idea about the consequences of changes. You can, of course, make a state about the chemical situation in the stratosphere as it is. But if you change one factor, what would happen? And the political and the legal system are, of course, have the necessity to change one factor or another one and should know about the consequences. And increasingly, science says, well, we cannot know it. It's too complex for scientific, for prognosis. And then we have this political expertise and the distrust in technology and science on the societal level. And I could continue to make examples like this. In Germany, for example, in the legal system, we have a constitutional court which tries to develop the law as a potential of control of the welfare state. But the welfare state operates with goals, with kind of objectives, and it is in the traditional legal dogmatics very difficult to handle goals. So we have a shift from in the interpretation of human rights or civil rights from subjective rights to values. And if you have only values, then of course the conflict between values is in every decision evident, and it becomes difficult to see how the judge will decide a conflict of values. Whereas the subjective framework of subjective rights was, of course, better able to direct the adjudication of the constitutional court. So there's again a conflict between the political system, and if the court tries to maintain the level of legal control of political decision making, it becomes very difficult to do this with reliable legal instruments. So again, the question whether systems in their own dynamics overburden other systems, and whether there is a constant conflict or a constant shift in the relations or interfaces between different function systems, which makes it then difficult to see the society as a rule for relations between function systems. So again, we have the situation that the idea of unity is fading away, and the unity in the sense of an essential structure, internal structure of the society, be it rank, be it division of labor. And now we have exactly this situation to which postmodernism reacts in a certain way, to say, well, there is no unifying symbol, no meta-récit anymore. But I think for a sociologist it would be more helpful to ask the question whether it is the right way to observe society as a unity contrasted with internal differences, a unity in spite of stratification, in spite of functional differentiation, some kind of sameness or identity, some kind of consensus, some kind of integration should be necessary in spite of differences, or whether we should see the society as a difference. And this is where we come into different and difficult theoretical waters, because how could we say that the society is a difference? And if you want to maintain that it is a unity, then you have to mark the other side. Unity distinct from what? How could the society organize or develop or have a kind of evolution as maintaining a difference in terms of what? What is then the proper way of operation? And what then is what is excluded by boundaries from the society. And at this point, I think we can make certain kinds of propositions, certain kinds of ideas coming from modern development of system theory. And at the final part of my lecture, I would like to see make this point and show some kind of possibilities of research, of developing of theory on the basis of the idea we need a distinction, system and environment, and we need a kind of apparatus, theoretical apparatus, to explain why this distinction or this difference as a product of operation of a system can be maintained, or why it is even probable and almost without aspects of catastrophe or ending of life in the organic field or of communication in the social field, whether it's possible to, and what are the problems in maintaining and reinforcing and reproducing the difference a system makes. Now, this comes very close to a development in system theory, which on various levels focuses on the distinction between system and environment. The system is not simply a whole or some kind of form or gestalt which exists as such and is to be characterized by the internal differentiation, the whole and the part. But increasingly we see that the system maintains itself by boundary maintaining, by maintaining a difference and replacing the problem of maintaining the difference or reintroducing the problem of maintaining the difference into the system. Now, I could, of course, give a long report about the developing of this idea within system theory from the theory of life as an exchange with the environment to theories of organization with input-output relations and so on and so forth. But I just have no time to do this here, but I wanted to point at few actual discussions about these problems and the consequences they have. One is that increasingly one insists on a kind of operational closure of systems. So life can be reproduced only by life, or there's a network of within a cell or within an organism, a network of products of the same system which makes it possible and probable that the system will continue to produce its own product or to reproduce its product out of its product. The term reproduction originally meant a production out of products. And so this is the famous autopoiesis discussion in biology and in increasingly also in social science. Could we imagine a system, in spite of all kinds of causal interferences between system and environment, could we maintain that it is operationally closed in the sense that the autopoietic organization or the reproduction of essentials of the system or the reproduction of the possibility of reproduction is guaranteed by the system as such? And there's a kind of evolutionary selection that autopoietic systems are tested in evolution whether they can do it or not, in spite of the kind of causality which we have, of course, always to assume. A brain is operationally closed, uses its own language, and so on and so forth. But of course, if you cut the head off, then the brain will stop. And so there are clear causal relations with the body. But in spite of this, we have operational closure. And I tend to apply this kind of idea of operational closure to the society, saying that society is closed on the level of communication. Communication, not action, communication, is the type of operation which produces a society and reproduces it out of its own project by a kind of recursive reference to previous communication and an anticipation of possibilities to continue communication. Not necessarily consensual, of course not reasonable, but in a way producing always the possibility to say yes and no, and to make a decision, I accept or I do not accept what is proposed, and then it goes on and everybody has a chance to make its own statements and continue the communication, reproducing always the difference between yes and no, or rejection and acceptance of propositions. And if you have this this idea of operational closure, which cuts across the old distinction between open and closed systems, the old distinction meant simply causal isolation. Closed systems are causally isolated, and therefore decaying in its tendency to entropy. But open systems can manage this problem. This old distinction is just no longer actual, and operational closure means not causal isolation. I have to make this point and repeat to make it clear, because there's all much confusion about this idea. If we call the economic system, for example, as an operationally closed system on the level of payments, communication via money is the autopoietic mechanism which maintains the economy separate from law, from politics, from science, and so. If you have this, then of course you get the objection, wow, we cannot have, we don't pay for nothing. I mean, we have our wishes, our needs, and our references to environment, and we are causally dependent on technology, and so on and so forth, and it is simply nonsense to say this is a closed system, but it is a closed system in the sense of operational closure. But then we need a second, and this is, the more important development in recent second-order cybernetics, but also in the mathematical calculus of George Spencer Brown in England, that you need to compensate for closure by reintroducing the or copying the distinction of system environment into the system. In the calculus of laws of form of George Spencer Brown, this is called a re-entry of a form into the form. That means of a distinction into what is distinguished. And this is, of course, completely clear in system theory. The system does not only produce a difference, but it makes itself, by its own operation, a distinction between system and environment. It copies what it produces as a difference, as a distinction into the system. So that the system distinguishes between self-reference and external references. Communication would work only if you make a distinction between words and things. If you could not make this distinction, you would simply not be able to communicate anymore. If you continually make confusion between the word apple and real apples and try to eat the word, this would not go very long. It would not be autopoetically possible. So, in a sense, the distinction between self-reference and external references is a necessity that means that the system cannot reach the environment with its own operation. It cannot get out of the system with its own operation. This would simply be an enlargement of boundaries, but it can compensate for this impossibility by using a internal distinction, mind and reality or whatever. In Husserl, this is in the phenomenology, transcendental phenomenology of Husserl, it's very clear the distinction between noises, the consciousness of being conscious, and the phenomena the reference to phenomena, which are not outside facts, but simply a correlate to consciousness. We cannot have consciousness only by thinking, I'm conscious. About what? Is then the next question. So the idea of compensating for closure by a kind of re-entry mechanism is not quite new, but the consequences are more or less intriguing and more or less difficult to accept. The consequence is that the system becomes intransparent or undeterminable for itself. In Spencer Brown's treatise, there is a kind of remark that if you have a re-entry of a distinction into itself, you have irresolvable undeterminacy. And the interesting point is that this kind of intransparency, the system for itself, is not because the environment is too complex. It is not the scheme of dependent and independent variables. It's not the problem of parameters. It is a self-created uncertainty, self-created intransparency, self-created problem which you can solve only within the system. And the way out of this kind of self-created uncertainty is to use time. To use time in a quite new sense of... well, this becomes complicated. Making a difference between, or distinction between, future and past. Past and future. And locating all kinds of operations at the moment where they take place in a present which lives from a difference between past and future. You need, on one side, a memory function. Somehow, memory should be present and not as a kind of occasional use of past experience for present purposes, not a kind of memory, well, yesterday I bought this, and yesterday, where did I forget it? What did I do yesterday, and how did I come from the airport to the city, and how can I come back? I have to remember the way. This is quite occasional, but this new type of memory function is a function which is part of every operations. If something is familiar to us, that's something that I know, that I can drink water, I don't remember the occasion when I learned to drink water. It's just a kind of familiarity which limits the frame for the future. So memory function on one side and the oscillation function on the other side. Oscillation in the sense that you have always to make distinctions and you can cross the boundaries. If we have the distinction of say, good and bad behavior, we could, of course, if we want to be virtuous, we can, of course, not avoid the possibility to be non-virtuous, to addict to vices. And so this scheme, virtue-vice, is an oscillatory scheme. You cannot have one side only. You have always both sides, and you have the possibility of crossing. And this possibility of crossing all kinds of distinctions is the indicator that it is future. Now, I could go into comparing this kind of temporal idea, distinction of past and future, by memory on one side and by oscillation on the other side, and then comparing this with our traditional concept of time as a measure of a process, as a kind of chronology, a kind of number system, and we have Wednesday or Friday and we are at this date, and so the continuity of time is guaranteed by the distinction between mobile and immobile states, by a kind of flux, a kind of stream of time, which presupposes then that not everybody, everything is on the same level of movement. This is our traditional European idea of time, and I think we are approaching with the system theory a completely different idea of time, based on the question, who makes the distinction? When do we make a distinction between past and future? And what is the guarantee that we do make tomorrow the same distinction between past and future if we have a different memory and if we prefer different distinctions for oscillation between one side or the other side? So the idea of time becomes relative to the idea of the observer. Who observes time, and that it is time is seen by the distinction of before and thereafter, or past and future, and memory and oscillation. But how this distinction, what is available as memory, and what kind of distinction I use for oscillation? It is true, false, or bad, good, or more and less, are useful, not useful, or kind of quite of personal distinction. Should I travel to London or to Oslo? And if I cannot be at the same place at the same time, at both places, so I have to make a decision and oscillate between two possibilities. So this all depends on a idea of the observer, who is the last reference in choosing or reactualizing his memory and choosing a distinction for future oscillation, which includes distinguishing the distinction, whether we are political interested in having power and having an office to spend power, so to speak, or whether we are scientists and think in terms of theories and demonstration of truth and so on and so forth, or whether we are family, have an interest in maintaining our family and organizing everything around family life, neighbors and tastes and solution of internal problems and so on and so forth. This, that's the last point, can be seen as a question to as the question, what is reality in this kind of thinking? If you have no contact to the environment, if you cannot reach the outside with your own operations, if you cannot think out of your brain or your consciousness, and if you cannot communicate with, say, chemicals to say, well, change, please, your poisonous effects and your pollution, you cannot say it to the chemicals and then hope that they will either obey or not obey. They will not even understand. So the if we have this kind of operational closure, we must internalize the reality aspect in the sense that what is then reality? Traditionally, of course, reality is always, since Kant, a result of a test using the resistance of the outside, the Ding an sich, as a resisting force. If it doesn't go, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And then we know not the reasons, and we have to construct our own ideas about why it doesn't work. But that it doesn't work is an impact of the environment on the system. But if we cannot check whether it works or not, because we have only internal operations, what is then the reality? What is meant by reality in this kind of theory? And I think we should not give up the idea of resistance, but we should replace or place it into the system and say that it is the result of or the solution of an internal conflict. And it is the result of a resistance of operations of the system against operations of the same system. So there is a resistance of communication against communication. If I present a theory and everybody shakes his head, then no, that's unacceptable. And I find always in the communication resistance, then it is a kind of reality test within the system, without any regard to outside questions, purely on the level of communication. And this, of course, has to do with the theory of memory, which I tried to outline just before. So memory is the possibility of resistance against new ideas, new irritations, new impulses, new problems. We have always to check whether it works within our memory frame. There is no other check. This is, by the way, that's again a Paul de Man formula, resistance of language against language, as a kind of, and this refers again to postmodern literature. But the background is completely different. Now, a final remark. If we as sociologists offer such complicated and to large extent unplausible or difficult to conceive idea about society, about the world, about systems in general, then could we contribute to the self-description of modern society? Could we expect as sociologists to influence the way people think about society, about the world, about modernity, and so on and so forth? Or is this because the theory is so abstract, so complicated, so unusual to accept, so contradicting everything we take for granted in everyday life, so that there are other people outside, and so, or could we not have this kind of idea? And I'm rather skeptical from many kind of discussions and also from the relatively isolation of this kind of self-referential system theory already in the intellectual discourse of the last decades, and the difficulties to explain this. I'm rather skeptical whether we could compete with what mass media normally present as the world, the society, with preference to moral integration, to moral values, to good and bad guys, and to action, to persons, and to catastrophic events, and so on and so forth. And our normal everyday awareness of the society and the modern world and the ecological problems, everything is so much determined by the mass media that it would be difficult to compete with the mass media. But this does not mean that we are not able to write a better theory of modern society. Although if this is only for sociological purposes, for improving theories in our special scientific field. And I think if we can do this, this is already a lot. Thank you very much.
Professor Luhmann would be happy to take some questions. We've got some time. Nobody's coming in here now.
Yes, thanks.
Excuse me, I have acoustic problems. That's too much noise around.
Can you speak a bit louder? I'm just wondering about this problem of intimacy.
Yeah.
Operation
Yeah.
What sort of theory helps us understand that problem?
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I think I have in mind two different authors which know each other, of course. That's one is the mathematical calculus of Spencer Brown, a student of Russell, starts with the injunction, make a distinction, otherwise you cannot indicate anything. You have to distinguish what you indicate from everything else, at least from the unmarked state of the world around it. And then the idea of re-entry leads to it is a hidden paradox, because if a distinction re-enters itself, it is on one side the old distinction that re-enters itself, but as a distinction which has re-entered itself, it is already a different one. So it is a paradox, and in some sense, I think the solution of that's the part of the seminar this afternoon. The solution of a paradox is for Spencer Brown the idea that you could not use traditional arithmetic or algebra to solve these kind of problems. You have to go in the field of secondary functions, in the field of imaginary spaces, imaginary numbers, and so on and so forth. And then you cut the expectation that numbers refer to realities which can be counted, and you have irrational problems within the mathematical calculation. And you cannot use the traditional forms anymore. And it goes not very far beyond this. Unresolvable indeterminacy is a formula in this context. It is also clear that it is not unresolvable because it is outside of the system. It is a self-created problem, created by re-entry. But there is no clear indication how you can have a new calculus. And oscillation, in the sense of Spencer Brown, is then simply an oscillation between marked and unmarked. If you mark something, you can, by marking, not ignore the fact that there's unmarked space or unmarked state of the world around. And there are some comments on it that all observations severs the world into two parts, and the unity is no longer visible. But there is no unresolvable indeterminacy means that that there is no calculus available within the traditional things. And the other reference is Heinz von Förster. He has a collection of essays in English Observing Systems. And the latest one are not in this collection. This is from 81. But he makes a distinction between trivial and non-trivial machines. Trivial machines are machines which produce, if you give the same input and the same transformation function works, you have the same output. And if it doesn't come out, then the machine needs repair. There's something wrong with the machine. So if you say, the machine makes clack, 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 and then it comes one. And if you say B, clack, 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 and two. And if you say again A, then it comes again one. In the non-trivial machines, this is no longer, these are self-referential machines which use their own output as input without distortion by environmental effects, without something new. That's a Turing machine in a sense. And these machines are unreliable because, for example, if you get a question from your teacher and you give the answer, it may be right or wrong. But then if the question is repeated, then you ask, why does he ask the same question once more? And then you say, well, you ask, you give not the answer, but you ask, what does it mean to ask always the same questions? So you have a new state of mind produced by repetition, and you become unreliable. And the idea for education is interesting. Hans von Förster says that our educational system tries to educate trivial machines, giving always the correct answer to questions. But we should educate unreliable people, which have always the idea that could invent something new if the context is boring, or if you have no ideas, why not change your mind? And then, of course, on this level of non-trivial machines, and unreliability of their operational modalities, then you have the question of how to have an idea of education, how to have a kind of decision-making theory. One of the ideas is that decision-making is, you need decisions only in the case of undecidable issues. Otherwise, it is clear, the matter is clear, and how to cope constantly with undecidable issues by decisions. So these are the, and the reason is, of course, mathematically stated. If you have a re-entry or an output as input of the system explodes in possibilities. And I don't know the exact form of calculation, but Hans von Förster, if you have four inputs and four outputs, and if you introduce the outputs as inputs, you have an astronomical number of possibilities, and nobody will, not the system as it's such, and not the no outside observer can know what it is, what it will do. And we have this, I think, also in Romantic literature. In Jean Paul, for example, he says, you cannot make a prognosis of your own will. It's, will is unprognosticable. I cannot fix my will for tomorrow.
There are three more questions waiting.
Yeah.
One there.
Well, this is partly a reformulation or redescription of the classical ideas of sociology of knowledge. That semantic states means ideas or concepts or words which are in a certain use and change their use. And social structure refers to social conditions. And the point, the distinction between this kind of sociology of knowledge and the classical one, Marx, Mannheim, and so, also the Edinburgh Science Unit, that on the other side is not simply interest or power, but the forms of differentiation. So I try within this, these are essays, more or less long essays, on historical matters like concept of time, like love, ideas about passionate love, and so on and so forth, reason of state. And the idea is that the semantics changes on almost all concepts are changed during the 17th and 18th century as a response to a new form of differentiation, to a transition from stratificatory differentiation to functional differentiation. And this has to do with a work in Bielefeld of historians like Kozelek, who say that the late 18th century, the last third of the 18th century, centering around French Revolution, did change all social and political concepts in Europe. And I, but this is just an historical observation, description, but not no explanation why this is so. And I try to say that if we have a radical change in the dominant pattern of internal differentiation of the society, then even, of course, interest change, power change, the concept of interest is invented in this kind of a transition, or it gets a new meaning. So the real other side of the distinction is not interest, but social differentiation.
I was interested in your wondering at the end whether it was really possible to influence human thinking using these complex sociological theories. From my field, operational research has used arguably some very watered down, simplified ideas from systems thinking, but has actually used them to intervene in the world. I'm thinking of viable systems model of Stafford Beer, Forrester's work in system dynamics, Chetham's work in soft systems methodology, which attempts to draw on Husserl's work. My question is, do these activities offer a more practical hope of creating a deeper, more systemic worldview? And if they do, should sociologists be more interested in them?
Well, there are two possibilities to answer this. The first is whether this is already not on the level of the more recent theories of self-referential systems, and whether we have simply the necessity to simplify, or whether there is within system theory development in the direction of second-order thinking, of inbuilt self-reference into systems, and so this is one question, or one type of answer, and I think that we should reformulate the Stafford Beer type of cybernetics in these more recent terms. But then the question, in my experience, is that there is indeed a possibility, especially in the business consultant work, to use autopoietic ideas and to use the Palo Alto type of constructivism in family therapy. So there is no, the consultant doesn't know the reality, and he has to use certain tests or certain prescriptions to see whether this has a diagnostic value. If the prescription doesn't work, he is a little bit more informed about reality than, and otherwise it would be work, and then things are okay. And the background assumptions are indeed on the level of this kind of second order cybernetics, this kind of constructivist epistemology, and they are well. I have regular meetings with people from family therapy and business consultants, and they try to work with this kind of thinking. But then the interesting point is that they cannot communicate their background ideas. They cannot convince a normal enterprise that it is an autopoietic system. So they need the theory to generate ideas, and but the language level is different within the group, within the team, within the internal educational mechanism of family therapists or business consultants, which mix more very much nowadays. But in fact, it is influential on this field. But if I think of politics, I was in, I must say, in former parts of my life, I was a member of government committees and so on. There were formidable language restrictions to use this kind of committee work, and so it is. I'm rather, there are certain slots, certain possibilities of access on a more immediate therapeutic or consultant work, but I doubt whether this will influence the the idea the public or normal people have about modern conditions of life.
Up on the balcony.
Thank you. I suppose it follows on from what the previous question asked and where you just arrived at. I was just wondering, too, about your skepticism at the end towards social science and how it relates to society. I was just wondering, a different way of formulating the problem is that we all have self-images of society. We decide whether we conceive of our society as being a free one or an equal one or a democratic one and whatever. And against might say that social science can arrive at a rather different view of the type of society we live in, and that advances in knowledge could perhaps depart from our common everyday understanding of what society is like. And I just wonder whether you would agree that there might be some conflict between the two, and that in that sense there could be some sort of influence of one on the other, as opposed to the mass media perhaps overwhelming us with their understanding of
well, I would not deny the possibility. I would rather say this is a kind of random problem. Maybe something is successful. Maybe some ideas. I found politicians in Germany using the term Kontingenzbewältigung, contingency management, without knowing what contingency means and what results are can be expected from management of contingency. But so on the rhetoric level, there is a certain influence. And I think also that that there are some roots which are more probable than others. My experience now is, for example, in the discussions about ethics, it is. I'm invited every year to three, four, five conferences about ethics, about ecological ethics, about banking ethics, about whatever kind of ethics, and I don't see the ethics. I mean, I see the attempt to formulate rules. But this is a kind of para-legal thing, but it has nothing to do with Kant, not with Bentham, not with any kind of academic ethical tradition. And normally I use in this discussion the distinction good-bad or good-evil, and then say whether is the distinction good or bad? You could say, well, ethics is good. Why it is bad? It is good, of course. To make a distinction between good and bad is good. But then are you responsible for the consequences if they are in ethnic or religious disputes? And I propose normally that it's bad to make a distinction between good and bad. Like in the paradise, it was forbidden, I mean, to make this distinction. Now it is of, to use moral terms, is of the highest degree of immorality. Just to take the distinction from the other side. And then it is, they think that's either a kind of devilish trick to avoid ethical constraints on behavior or whatever. I was even asked in a theological setting in Mexico whether I have close contact with the devil. I say no context. No, I am the devil. if you have fashionable things like culture, ethics, it is hard to get on a level of reflection which uses this kind of observational theory. I think it's. We need a mixed answer to your question, and we could not. The prognosis is very difficult. The political consultancy in my life was very disappointing, partly because I didn't care for party support, you could not do anything without a good party support in Germany at least, So, and the understanding with political friends was that I should refrain from going into committees and rather try to develop my own theory and not be spending every Friday in Bonn. Well, on the level of in the biological field, I'm of course not competent to answer this question, but my impression is that the theory of autopoiesis simply ignores the question of the beginning. Partly because the question is when a system really becomes autopoietic and what was the previous state. The previous state has no explanatory function for the understanding of, for example, when DNA came into use in the living mechanism. This doesn't explain much of the biological structures because this is then a question of evolution. It sets a kind of evolutionary possibility free free under the only constraint that it should not prevent autopoiesis, and the whole distinction of living forms does not depend on the beginning. It is not a kind of original state which explains the later things. But in my interest is more to transfer this to social systems, and to say that communication is autopoietic in the sense that you can only communicate not as a single act without previous and later act, but just referring to previous communication. And then you have, of course, the question when, for example, a function system becomes autopoietic. For example, when the legal system actually becomes autopoietic in the sense that it creates its own premises. And then my idea would be that it needs a kind of evolutionary advance, or a kind of preparedness of society, so that the legal system can interpret, if it's begin to work on an autopoietic sense, it can use previous habits, customs, as law, which they were not, as law separate from religion, for example, And the same is true with the monetary economy. When people did invent coined money, it was not in the 6th century before Christ, it was not invented as an exchange mechanism. But as soon as it became adapted to an exchange mechanism, then of course the possibilities of economic exchange explored, and then you could interpret the old credit mechanism in merchant houses and so as economic. But before it was simply household. And so there's a redescription of history within the autopoietic system to adapt history or previous states to the assumption that the system was always autopoietic. Yeah, I think that's it is partly helpful to avoid the assumption that some states of society are naturally good. we could avoid the idea that market society is superior as well, just as market society, and see the problems we have, for example, with international financial systems, and to suggest a responsibility for decision making, for choosing structures which goes beyond the idea that there are good principles and bad principles. Planning is bad, and so. And I had an interesting discussion with a Chinese. He was in the embassy in Bonn and is now was then minister, I don't know, in China, about economic development. And so he wanted to make he accepted a dissertation on the autonomy of science and did even finance it from China. And then the discussion was as follows. Why did you do this? Why did you think of science as a system? Well, he says, we would multiply the gross national product with 4 until the year 2000, and we are clear that that this needs a scientific base. So we want 4 or 5 years to make science and then apply it to the economy. And then my question was how large the percentage of application he thinks of science, and his answer was 100%, of course. And I said, well, we are used to think in terms of 15 or 18 or 20% usable scientific results, and well, that's capitalistic waste. We don't do this. We have to learn. And then my further question was, how could you make a distinction between economic rational and economic irrational application of science, and without mobile prices, without changeable prices, without market conditions? And then the discussion went another way. But so what kind of questions we have to ask, this would be make a difference. Not so much what kind of solution we can propose, but what is the problem? What is the problem? And in the East Germany, I think one of the problems is the habit to expect everything from organization, from state, from the lack of awareness of the necessity of risk in your own life. And so, but there is no, I think, no one answer to this question, but confronted with daily problems in these countries, I think it's always, you have other ideas, and the most part, mostly other problems.
I think 3 more only. First one there.
On? Resistance, oh yeah. Well, this depends very much on what kind of system you have in mind. If I take the brain, for example, or the centralized nerve system, neural system, then I think the resistance is just in the habits of linking mechanisms, and a kind of conflict solution. For example, you have a confused way. If you have 2 eyes, you have a confused picture. In the you have a conflict, and what you see is the resolution of the conflict, not something which is imported from the outside. But you create an indeterminate situation via different ways to look at the reality, and you solve it with space distinction. Or in memory, if you have, if we would have no time idea yesterday and today and so on and so forth, we would have everything at the same time. That means unresolvable conflicts. But if you have time, you can say, well, this was yesterday. I was on the airport yesterday, and now I'm here. So it is not a confusion. We can solve by temporal distinctions many of the problems. And then time becomes a real indicator of reality. And I think we could use the same idea in communication, in the sense that you have resistance. If you have crazy ideas, you don't find acceptance in your public, and you eliminate things, and you can use innovation, but innovation is always pre-tested, what could be accepted and what not. So the communication always the possibilities of a yes and a no as an answer. You can reject or accept what is proposed. And this is a kind of resistance, and you check always whether you find resistance or not. Of course, you can like to have resistance. You can like conflict, and you can provoke and have a kind of remote control. You provoke the public, and you know it would explode at least, and you enjoy it. But it is always a kind of checking the possibility of resistance in premeditating communication. Well, generally, I have the tendency to say to operate on the level of problems, and to change the conception of problems, and to leave the decision to the system. So, and to use decisions as in the system, not as I propose to the system, as a kind of testing of future. And to increase the awareness of decisions as a condition of prognostic activities in the system. If you don't decide anything, you have no possibilities of prognostic view of the future. If you do not fix a commitment, you could not say what would happen and what would not happen, and you could not correct your prognosis. So I tend to in activities of this type of consultant discussions or whatever, to work on the level of problems, to see, do you have the right problem? Or do you have the answer, but what was the problem? And then to have a kind of functional analysis to say, well, if this is a problem, you have a limited but a kind of functional equivalent solutions, and try one and see what happened, and be aware or remember that you made a decision, and you can have a kind of post-decisional regret and try to revise the decision. But I'm very reluctant, only if there are very crude mistakes where they didn't know where they didn't need any kind of consultant work, but in very crude cases, we can say this is simply wrong, and please revise your decision.
You explained earlier also the application of autokinesis in terms of to social systems, in terms of the legal system. harmful to specific organizations or companies? And if so, in what terms can you apply to that
subject? Well, yes, I think actually I'm working on a book on which will be published probably in Italy first, on organizational decision. And the idea is that the autopoietic mechanism is decision, in the sense that every premises of operations within a system has to be introduced in the form of decisions. Membership is a result of decision. Who is member, who is not member, what kind of obligations, what kind of acceptance, or what kind of indifference is presupposed by membership. And of course, programs are decisions, and of course, structures, hierarchies are results of decisions. So everything is based on a decision. And then you get habits and so-called organizational culture and so, but you can dissolve this again in decisions by saying that organizational culture or corporate culture is a result of decisions which has become undecidable. You forget simply that it was a decision or an aggregate of many decisions. And so reproduction of decision by decision making is the term of an autopoietic theory of organization, which needs a careful work on the concept of choice and decision. So I'm just reading Shackle, the British economist, in terms of what is choice and how did decision or choice produce something new, and so on and so forth. So I think if you use this kind of theory, you have not to be content to define decision as choice, but you have to explain how the elements of choice are distinguished in the first place. Well, there is a German version. Actually, it was a series of lectures at the University of Lecce, and they become translated into Italy, and I go to Italy in the May and in October to make it, to revise the translation, and to and then the German manuscript needs only cosmetic work, and the souterrain of footnotes needs improvement, and so. But the ideas are ready, and I try to find a publisher. That's always a problem, which almost simultaneously published in German and English. This is De Gruyter in Berlin, but so far there is some work to do.
Well, very, very reluctantly, I think we must stop there. But Professor Luhmann has given us a rich, suggestive lecture, which is going to be for us a memorable event in our centenary year. Thank you, sir.